Welcome to the Wedlake Bell Legal Podcast, covering a range of legal topics, including updates from our four practice groups: private client, real estate, business services, and dispute resolution.
Hello and welcome to the Wedlake Bell Legal Podcast, episode 4, English pre- and post-nuptial agreements. I'm Charmaine Hast and I'm the partner and head of the family department at Wedlake Bell. I'm joined today by Conrad Adam, who is also a partner in the family department. Hi, Conrad.
Hello and welcome. I hope you find the discussion today interesting.
The aspect of a pre- and post-nuptial agreement is actually very exciting, because I don't know what you think, Conrad, but it certainly takes the heat out of positions of dissolution, although it may take the romance out of premarital situations. What do you think?
I think that's right. I think people in England are getting more used to the idea of a pre- or post-nuptial agreement these days. I know, Charmaine, in your original jurisdiction of South Africa, of course, they've had anti-nuptial or pre-nuptial agreements for a very long time.
They have. But don't you find it really worrying that in England, regardless of whether you're wealthy or not wealthy, people are still resisting prenuptials? Which, do you think that's a clever idea or perhaps a bit more of ignorance and anxiousness?
I think there is still quite a level of confusion out there as to prenuptial agreements. Often you come across people who either think they're not worth the paper they're written on, or you come across people who think they're completely binding. But of course the reality is it's somewhere in between the two, and explaining that to people, I think, is the bit that we need to get across.
I think you're right on that, because people often say to you at dinner parties, well, prenuptial's worth nothing. And more exciting is the fact that people can actually in England have postnuptial agreements. But people at dinner parties say they're not worth the paper they're written on is quite a bit, very surprising.
Yeah, I think people need to understand that although the court in England still has something of a discretion, if a prenuptial agreement has been well drafted and if both parties have had separate legal advice and there's been a financial disclosure, then unless one of the parties can show that the terms of the agreement are unfair, generally speaking, the court in England will now uphold the terms of it. But I think that's quite a difficult thing for most people to fully understand. For lots of people, they think the law is sort of either black or white.
I think you've explained that incredibly well, because really, it's fairness of the prenuptial. I have a lot of men who say to me, I've now met the woman of my dreams, I'm worth a lot of money, but actually, I want to give her nothing unless she behaves herself. And the difficulty with that, of course, is that it has to be fair. And people do think they can get away with a prenuptial agreement that gives nothing, which in our language means it's probably worth nothing.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I always much prefer there to be some negotiation by the other party and their advisors on a prenuptial agreement as well. I'm always very nervous if you put forward some proposals and the other side immediately says snap. I prefer it to have been some negotiations, so that if it's questioned later on, you can go back to the file and show that there has actually been proper engagement by the other side.
Absolutely, and I think that's one of our basic legal principles of English law, is that it must be negotiated, because how do we know? They don't get home and he holds a gun to her head and says, if you don't sign that, I'm cancelling the dress, or I'm cancelling the wedding, or I'm taking the ring back. Yeah. So negotiation is very important, and a lot of our court cases do refer to the old files, what was negotiated. There's almost a temptation, don't you think, to make it a little bit of a document capable of negotiation when drafting it in the first instance?
Yeah, I think that's really important. So very often you might put forward proposals in agreement with your client in the expectation of the other party coming back and wanting to change certain things or increase certain things. So I think it's a good idea, as you say, to build in some negotiating room or wriggle room in expectation of people coming back to you seeking something different.
Yeah. And how have you found people saying to you, how do I approach the love of my life and tell her that I'm not going to carry out what I say at the altar, what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours, but everything is both of ours? How do you speak to clients and tell them this is how you sell it to your future love of your life and why you should have a prenuptial?
I think that's still a tricky point for lots of people to tackle. I think the sooner the conversation takes place, the better. So if it's something that your fiancé, or before you even get engaged, the person who you anticipate marrying, if it's a conversation that you have as soon as possible, that also assists to get rid of any idea that there was undue influence or undue pressure on the other party. But I think as well, quite often these days, the pressure is coming from other people. And I know both of us, Charmaine, we act for quite a lot of people in prenuptial agreements where it's one of the sets of parents who are actually looking to protect family wealth before making inheritances or gifts later on in the marriage. So often there is somebody else, not that you can blame if you like, but there's somebody else who is pushing things forward, and you can explain it in that way.
Because I've often found that it's always much easier blaming someone else. Yeah. So the wealthier party can always say, you know, if it was just me, darling, it would be fine. But actually, my accountant wants me to do it, or my practice wants me to do it, or my partners at work require me to do it, or my parents, or the trustees of my trust. And if it was just me, I'd give you everything. So that is always a very difficult part of advising on prenuptial agreements. And I'm glad to hear that you have that problem as well. But in my view, one of the good things about the word fair is that it is going to prevent somebody with no experience in family law shooting from the hip and drafting a prenuptial agreement that's not going to be worth the paper it's written on. You and I know in the years gone by when we've had people like, I'm not saying all mediators, but mediators have tried to instill a standard as to being a mediator, but lots of fly-by-nights have popped up everywhere for mediators. Whereas for prenuptial agreements, you're not easily going to find an app, even if you could create the algorithms, nor could you have the corner store providing you with an in-house service, or the local supermarket providing you with a prenuptial agreement, because fairness has got to be the essence of English law.
I think it's very important that proper consideration is given by an experienced family lawyer to the drafting of a prenuptial agreement, because concepts such as fairness are quite difficult, and fairness to one person can mean something completely different to fairness to another person. And I also think the reason why you need an experienced family lawyer to draft a prenuptial agreement is because a well put together prenup can turn the clock back at least 18 years to before the case of White and White in 2000 and the sharing principle. And so if you even have a family practitioner who hasn't been practicing for that long, I think you have to question whether or not they would even know what the pre-White and White law was. Because if you think that a properly constructed prenup can turn back time, if you like, and act as something like a time machine to the type of claims that could be brought before the case of White and White, that's where I think having a number of years' experience behind you will enable you to assess what might be considered fair and what might not be considered fair.
Don't you think the public are extremely vulnerable when one considers family law generally? Because I often say to newly qualified solicitors that family law is a lot more difficult than other aspects of law, because it is not like dealing with a lease. It's not like dealing with a contract which says you shall pay and you will do. Very few members of the public realise that family law is a discretionary jurisdiction. So if you had six judges sitting around a table and you asked them what was fair, you will find that of the six judges, they will all come out within a particular slice. And it is within that slice that the correct decision or correct result is received. So actually, family law fairness is something, as you say, you only get with experience. But I think one of the most amazing things about English prenuptials is the fact that the solicitors got to commit themselves in a certificate attached to the document to say they've given the advice. And I've seen some prenuptial agreements and some postnuptial agreements where the solicitors have really opened themselves up to rather large potential negligence claims because they haven't signed the certificate correctly. So this is an area which I would anticipate in 5 or 10 years' time, we're going to see a lot of litigation, unfortunately, involving solicitors more than the parties fighting between them. So I think that your view on fairness and experience is essential. And I think the other thing, which is very interesting in English law, is the requirement to disclose assets.
Yeah, I think, again, that's sometimes a point of resistance, even with your own clients, and perhaps if it's being pushed forward by the parents of your clients, there is a resistance often to disclose what the level of wealth is. But I think it's fundamentally important, and all the guidance says that that should be done, because in the landmark case on prenups, the Rademacher case, it was said that the court should give effect to a nuptial agreement, so whether it's a prenup or a postnup, which has been freely entered into, so that means no coercion, with a full appreciation of its implications, which means independent legal advice and a financial disclosure, so that the other party knows what they're giving up, unless in the circumstances prevailing, it's not fair to hold the parties to it. So really it's a threefold test, freely entered into with a full appreciation of the implications, unless it's unfair. And so to have a full appreciation of the implications, you do need to make a financial disclosure. So I think that that's very important. And sometimes both of us have clients where they are trying to resist having to do that. But if you explain to them that it's one of the fundamental things that will make the court attach more weight to the agreement, then normally they're willing to provide the information.
Mm. And I also think, Conrad, that very few members of the public realise that when you're dealing with a prenuptial agreement in England or a postnuptial agreement in England, it is actually only applicable to England and Wales. And some people have this concept of Great Britain or the United Kingdom, and that prenuptial agreement may not necessarily be valid in Scotland or Ireland. And more importantly, our prenuptial agreements in England are not registered. And there are some countries in the world where prenuptials are not registered. How often do you in your prenuptial agreements reflect which country will have jurisdiction in the unfortunate event of the marriage breaking down?
I always talk to clients about that, particularly if there is a connection with a foreign country, either in terms of property or assets being abroad, or if one of the parties has a connection with a foreign country, where there is a possibility that if there are divorce proceedings, they may take place abroad. Normally, unless there's very good reason otherwise, the agreement that I would draft would talk about the English court having jurisdiction and English law being applied. If the parties do have assets in foreign jurisdictions, or there is a prospect of divorce in a foreign jurisdiction, then the general advice would be for the clients to consider having mirror agreements in any other jurisdiction where they might have significant assets, or where a divorce might end up taking place.
I think that leads on to a very interesting topic, which is jurisdiction races, because the world is such a small place now, and people do move between countries far easier now than they did 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. And it's a very interesting concept, particularly with the dreaded word Brexit. One finds that, from my experience, what is applicable today is not necessarily applicable to a family in 10 years' time or 15 years' time. And the question of jurisdiction and which is going to be the operative jurisdiction, as chosen by the parties, is something which people don't often focus on.
Yeah, I think that's right, and people do move around. I think if the parties end up getting divorced in England, then irrespective of where their prenup has been drawn up, for example, in the Rademacher case, it was a German prenup. But the court made it clear in that case that if the divorce is in England, then the English courts will always apply English law. And although that might seem obvious, that isn't actually the case sometimes in other jurisdictions. And so you might find, for example, very strange things happening whereby, say, the Italian court might have jurisdiction to deal with the divorce, but because of the particular circumstances of one or both of the parties, the Italian court might end up applying English law, but Italian procedure. So it can get extremely complicated. I think at least we can take some comfort in the fact that we know that if the divorce is in England, at least the English court will be applying English law.
Yeah, I think it's interesting the way you chose the example of Italy, because of course Italy doesn't have prenuptial agreements. So you're asking a foreign court to deal with something foreign to them in more ways than one. So I think my own feeling is that dealing with foreign jurisdictions on an everyday basis, that the comfort the public can get is that I have found that the English requirements for fairness and for justice is recognised in a lot of other countries. My experience tells me that even English prenuptials are readily accepted in the colonies and states in America, in Europe, and certainly in Canada and the Far East, because they consider the English system to be one of utmost fairness and care and trust. So I think if people do have an English prenuptial, they can at least be satisfied that the jurisdiction that it's being drafted in is one which is probably the best, in my view, in the world.
I think that's right. And the jurisdiction clause would normally say that even if the divorce proceedings do take place in a country other than England, it is intended that the terms of this prenuptial agreement will be upheld in any jurisdiction. And the parties, both of them, confirm that it's their intention that wherever they may end up divorcing, they want the court in that jurisdiction to apply the terms of this agreement.
That's excellent. Well, I think, Conrad, that gives everyone a taster of what is available to take out of any sad, hard-fought, difficult situation when a marriage breaks down, the area of most contention, which is money. And I would urge the public to give serious consideration to making this an everyday occurrence for people, both with and without money, because people getting married now, as you and I have often seen, sometimes don't have assets now, but they're a success story in many years to come. So my advice would be get legal advice, deal with it, and it will help you in the long run. What do you think about that sort of approach?
Yeah, I think that's right. Nobody knows what the future might hold, but I think it's very important, at least for people who are planning on getting married, to think about these issues and think about what might happen in the future and what they might expect to happen financially. I think also, of course, the divorce rate being what it is, a lot of people are getting married for a second time. And if they are older and if they've already accumulated some assets, and for example, they already have children from a previous relationship, then before getting remarried, they certainly should be considering a prenuptial agreement as well, because they have children they may wish to protect in the event of any subsequent divorce.
Well, anyway, I think that's really good advice, and if anybody does need to contact us, please feel free to do so. Our information is on our website, and it is the Family Department at Wedlake Bell in London. Many thanks.
You just listened to the Wedlake Bell Legal Podcast. If you liked our episode and want to know more, then check out our website, www.wedlakebell.com. Wedlake Bell. Building relationships is at the heart of everything we do.